I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, New York Times bestselling author and CEO of Breather, Julian Smith, returns to the show to talk about managing uncertainty and constantly doing the best work of our lives. Before we start today's episode, I wanted to give you a quick update because we're in the midst of planning the next Instigator experience. If you missed out in 2014, this is not your typical business event because it's small, intimate, and leads to real results for the attendees. So if you want to get on the pre-launch list, take out your phone and text the word Instigate, all lowercase, to the number 38470, and you'll be able to get on the list and be notified when applications open up. Julian, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So, you know, we had you here back when we were called Blogcast FM, actually more than once. And, you know, the reason I wanted to bring you back was just because so much has changed in your life and your journey. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, your story, your journey, and how that has brought you to where you're at and what you're up to in the world today?
Sure. Yeah. The 10-year view of what I do, or the sort of 50,000 foot view of what I do, is that I follow trends in technology. And then I use those trends to create something interesting and new, and or be a part of something interesting and new. And then that usually sort of ends up taking my career to sort of a level it's never been at before. And so the first real example of this is I was one of the, it turned 10 years ago, in November 2004, actually almost exactly 10 years ago, I was one of the first podcasters in the world. And so when that happened, there weren't a lot of shows around. So when someone put together a podcast network, a friend of mine, CC Chapman, who I know is a friend of yours too, asked me to be one of the six shows, his being one of the shows, that was represented by this network. And that like basically liberated me from my first, from my last ever, you know, 9-to-5 job. And so at the age of 24, way ahead of like, just age-wise, way ahead of almost all of the people that were in podcasting at the time that ended up being like 30-something, 40-something, 50-something, like dudes sitting in a basement, I ended up like suddenly being like, well, I don't have a 9-to-5 job. Well, what do I do now? And that sort of helped me like get to the next level, next level, next level, next level. And so my most, you know, we can go through that whole thing if you want to, but yes, my most recent project that has led me to where I am now is I run a startup called Breather, which is at breather.com, like take a breather. And we've raised $7.5 million in venture capital funding. And we're in three cities all over the world, and it's really successful. So Very happy about it.
Well, let's do this. There's a couple of things. I do definitely want to go through sort of the step-by-step process of the journey that you just mentioned. But, you know, one thing I want to ask you is there's actually two things. One is around this ability to spot trends and build things around trends that help keep taking your career to the next level. Do you think that's something that's just inherently built into you? Or do you think that that's something that we can cultivate and we can develop? And if so, how?
Okay, so I think the answer is both. I'm sure you can become sensitive to it. It's actually, it's like such a key thing in terms of what I'm doing and what I do in my life that I actually ended up putting in my LinkedIn profile. If you go there, it says, I detect patterns. And so I really think that it is a skill, and I could probably, you know, in a period of this interview, teach you a lot about how to do it. But I also think that it's something that I happen to be good at. And I'll be able, hopefully, to be able to sort of dissect one from the other. But I would say that's definitely one of the key things that I have been able to do in my life that has taken me to where I am today.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you said you know you could probably teach us some of it. Can you give us sort of a framework for how we might incorporate this into our own lives, into our own projects, and into our own work?
Okay. So it's really complex, but let me start with like kind of an analogy that I've used once before. So technology, or any trend, really, is a series of Jenga blocks that are sort of built on top of each other like a tower. And so, you know, it's interesting because I'm reading the Playboy interviews in this book called Moguls, which is all about all of the, I don't know, sort of very successful entrepreneurs of the past 30 years. and it included an interview with Ted Turner, an interview with Steve Jobs that I'm just finishing right now from 1985 after the Macintosh had come out. So I'm reading through this, and he goes, the interview keeps saying, but what is a computer for? And he's like, well, look, if you're in business, a computer is to help you do math better and help you create better, more professional documents. And he's just going through the most elementary shit you've ever heard in your life. But the interviewer doesn't understand it because it's 1985. So he's trying to explain to Playboy magazine, I guess, that the future gets built on platforms and technologies and tools such as this one, and that he just invented one, and that he doesn't know what's going to happen, but that this is going to be the center of it, the computer. And so things are always being built like that. Benedict Devin, who's a really famous sort of trend analyst and now a venture capitalist for Andreessen Horowitz, which is a venture capital fund, he's talking about the watch. And he's talking about the Apple Watch in a way that that people are saying, the same way like in mobile in 1999 or with pagers or something, everyone was going, but why the fuck do I need a pager? Like, what's the point? Why would I ever do that? People are kind of thinking about the Apple Watch in that way right now, even though it's quite sexy and all these things. So you're looking at this thing and going, what is this going to really enable? Like, what's different? You could never have predicted by looking at the mobile phone, you can never have predicted Uber, for example. Mm-hmm. But GPS plus screens plus all these issues create this system, which was previously impossible. The way that we at Breather think about that is we think about the same kind of platform, the same kind of tool that becomes available through physical space, which is like basically created through electronic locks. Mm-hmm. So electronic locks is this thing that allows you to open sort of a network of rooms with your phone, which is to us, an incredibly exciting and an incredibly revolutionary thing. And sure enough, like, you know, Playboy and Steve Jobs in 1985, the first question and most common question that people get when they hear about this is, they're like, but what would I use these rooms for? And so I think the sort of what I'm trying to express in my convoluted way is technology is a series of Jenga blocks that build on top of each other. And each Jenga block is necessary for the next Jenga block to exist. But we can't predict what will happen ahead of time. Mm-hmm. But we always have to be saying, oh, here's this new tool. What does this new tool allow me to do over and over and over and over and over again? So that's one of the things that you have to be looking at. That's not trends per se, but it's sort of an important building block of trends, which is what is possible today that was not possible before. And then there's other parts of that. I mean, I can keep dissecting this forever, but let me just give you one more example. There's also the same effect occurs societally. Once you have Coke, then, the positioning of Coke is, it's, you know, about happiness, but the way traditionally what Coke is known for is for being the real thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what they used to say about Coke. They said about Coke for like 50 years, 60 or 70 years. And so when Coke becomes the real thing, then Pepsi can become the choice of a new generation, right? Like the positioning exists in the brain that Pepsi has because of the fact that Coke is the old thing. And so over and over and over again, positioning exists and is created based on previous things in the brain or previous things in the world, the same way that you're placing furniture in a room. And once you place the couch somewhere, well, that allows you to put a table next to it, and now you've got a living room or something. It sounds really basic, but those things are fundamental to everything that we build every day. And so the people that are coming up with trends or that are working with them are looking at new tools or new things in the market and saying, well, how does that enable me to create my thing? Like, for example, I have a friend of mine who's just like obsessed and legitimately could do it, obsessed with creating a brand name American sake. And sake is like a Japanese Japanese rice wine, and there is no real American sake. And so he's convinced that with enough entertainment money and marketing money, he can create a brand the same way that Red Bull is in a category that didn't exist before, and the same way that coconut water is in a category that didn't exist before. And now coconut water is a like $3 billion industry out of nowhere. And you're in California, so you probably saw this happen before we did. So, you know, so all these things are like, there are things being built on top of each other. And so now people are saying, oh, well, you need a relaxation drink, just like we have a bunch of uppers, we have downers. So things are being built on top of each other over and over and over again. And the way that I generally sort of make decisions is going, what is the least competitive thing to do? What is the newest thing to do where a few, only very few people can follow me? And based on those things, you can probably create like a career or a couple years of your life where you're going to have a kind of a cool, successful thing for a while. And then maybe a new trend will emerge and then you'll go on it and do that thing.
All right. So a couple more questions. I want to actually take that back and tie it to the trajectory of your career. But I want to talk about one other thing you said before we get into the trajectory of your career, which is, you know, you found yourself at a certain age without a 9-to-5 job. And one of the things that's always been fascinating to me about you is sort of the mindset that you approach all of this with and how you've cultivated that. Because, you know, I mean, when I look at this and when I look at so many people who do this kind of work, I look at the amount of uncertainty that people have to navigate, the amount of self-doubt that people have to overcome, and all the sort of obstacles that are actually internal. And I really want to hear your perspective on this because I feel like you're one of the people that really got this down in a way that I've not seen with a lot of other people.
Yeah, so maybe that's a thing. It's interesting because every time that you're doing this thing that we were just talking about a moment ago, you're also navigating this uncertainty of what if I'm wrong? I've built up, and actually, Ben Horowitz, another venture capitalist, I read a lot of venture capital blogs, would say something like, the number one most difficult thing to manage if you're a CEO of a company is to manage your own psychology. And so anyone who wants to become a professional or wants to become someone who's world class at something has to manage that uncertainty or have a handle on it before they're even able to handle all the external uncertainties that come along with that. And so it's really interesting because I free write every day. And right before this, I was free writing, which I do on my computer about 1,000 words a day. And sure enough, and I was like, and I was thinking about Jack Dorsey and Steve Jobs and Square and these kind of, you know, you think about the iMac in 1998. And the real reason the iMac happened is because the company was going to collapse, right? If the company was not at the point where it was going to collapse, he would not have had his back against the wall. And if he didn't have his back against the wall, then he could have made a safer decision. But he didn't have a choice. He's like, well, I have to turn around the entire company. We have like 9 days left of money in the bank or something ridiculous. And I'm going to have to – this better be the biggest, most revolutionary thing that we could possibly make. So there's no hedging. And so you have the, you have to almost like have a sentiment for yourself like, I have nothing to lose. If I have nothing to lose, I'm just going to go all the way and create like the most ballsy thing that I can possibly create. It's a really difficult thing to do, but it gets better with practice. And hopefully as you get older, you don't become risk averse, which I'm concerned about. But I think that's also like just based on what kind of person you are. Maybe you're born more risk tolerant or more risk averse. I don't know.
Well, first, you know, I have to comment on the 1,000 words a day routine because I cultivated that because of you and it led me to some pretty stellar places. So you know, it's interesting to listen to you talk about sort of, you know, back against the wall. And so two more questions come from that. One is the difference between a person who comes out of that whole experience of back against the wall, you know, better off in a way, you know, sort of like the Steve Jobs turnaround. The other question, you know, like what differentiates the person who accomplishes that versus the one who doesn't? And then the other question is that, you know, sometimes what happens is once you achieve success, strangely, you become more less risk averse or more risk averse, if you know what I'm saying. Like you accomplish what you try to, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, now I have something to lose. And I only know this from speaking through experience because, you know, last year it was nothing to lose. It's like, let's put on an event, let's write a book. And then suddenly all these things happen and you feel like you have something to lose all of a sudden. And I'm wondering how you don't lose that sort of mindset when you've achieved mm-hmm. what you set out to achieve?
Yeah, it's really hard. I think it has to do with being like really, not really down on yourself, but being really negative about your future. Like I had written probably 3 books mm-hmm. or something, plus a bunch of ebooks, plus like 1,000 blog posts in my time before I ran this company. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Like, what does this future look like? And I was like, well, this future looks much the same as it does today. And so I was noticing, you know, maybe I write a more breakthrough book. Oh, that seemed very difficult because at the time I felt like I had actually done my best work. Like I think the work, the Flinch, which is the book that I wrote with Seth Godin, is like, I don't know that I could do something that's more visceral and better than that right now. So, so that's a part of it where you're like, well, I did this and I've got, you know, 17,000 or whatever days to live. I better do something bigger than this in my life. You don't want to be the guy who's a football, high school football star. And then, you know, Napoleon Dynamite ends up shooting, playing football with himself in the field. Cause that's like the best part of his life and it's all gone. So it's like constantly trying to recreate sort of this new best life for yourself, whatever that means personally. And I don't know, I'm drawn towards that. You know, like I don't have a Wikipedia page yet. I want one. I really feel like everything over time is erased by, you know, everything that you've ever created is erased. And only a few things remain after, you know, I don't know, 20, 50, whatever number of years. One of them is a public company. That usually sticks around for a while, you know, or at least it's in the history books or something like that. And it's really actually easy you know, to get give happiness to you and the ones you love. I'm not saying I'm a pro at it, you know, but it doesn't require like $1 billion. It doesn't require a giant house. It probably requires like, you know, a nice dog and some friends that you can go have dinner with or something, right. You know, a couple times a week. And that's it. So after that, like you might as well just go for it is kind of the way that I think about it. But I've become conscious of the fact that a lot of people have different kinds of risk tolerance, and so the next best thing you can do, other than being the crazy person such as myself, is to be the guy who helps the crazy person, at which point you probably get a lot of upside mm-hmm. without the majority of the risk.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. You know, I'd never thought about it that way before, but you know, I love that you mentioned sort of a public company being one of those things that stands the test of time. I want to go back to something else you said about the Flinch. And how that was probably some of the best work that you've ever done. You know, and I keep thinking, you know, back to Art of Being Unmistakable. And when I look back, look at sort of what is the next thing I want to create, the Flinch is always what comes to mind to me. I want to know that even if the book doesn't sell as many copies as the first one, or even if it's not as popular, that I can look at the work and say, yeah, this is substantially better. This is substantially more well-written. And I'm really curious about how, you know, we do the best work of our lives in whatever endeavor we decide to partake in.
Yeah, I think the answer is with your back up against the wall with incredible amounts of pressure, suffering half the time, and then coming out the other side and said, I died a little in there. You know, it's weird. Like, I don't know, maybe I'm sort of half French, so like I'm really cynical about some things or whatever. Uh-huh. I was sort of made that way. There's this author called Hélène Cizou, and she's like, I don't know, one of the best, most famous, well-known authors in all of the French language. Mm-hmm. And what she would say is she would say, like, for any great work to be created, you have to die and put that piece of your life into it, and it goes away forever. And so whether that's, you know, it sounds good metaphorically, but the other part is that not only does it sound good, it also, if you think that way, you're going to say, well, I haven't suffered enough to create greatness or something like that. You know, I'm hoping that's not the case, uh-huh. but it probably is. And it's weird because maybe you have to be the kind of person, like, you know, you can be chill. And that's kind of my attitude is like, oh, you can be chill, you know, later. Mm-hmm. which is maybe a version of that kind of 80s phrase, like, I can sleep when I'm dead, but I don't think of it that way. Mm-hmm. I sleep a lot, you know, so when I get my best thinking done. But nonetheless, like, I'm like, well, this day is going to go by anyway. I might as well try something crazy and see what happens.
Right.
You know? And so, yeah, I don't know. I think it's just like, I wrote a blog post about this a long time ago about scars, right? Like this idea of like you get scars when you get hurt, and at the end of your life, like you better have a lot of scars.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't just come into the world. This is like very philosophical and like, I don't know, something. But you can't come out of this world or leave the world in the same way that you came into it. It means you didn't actually encounter the world if you don't have any scars, probably. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so, having this sense of like having a limited lifespan, in my case, it really helps. Like I used to have seizures. So I have epilepsy. My hearing is going away. I have all these other things that are reminding me, like, use your time wisely, because you may end up like that guy in the one video by Metallica in the bed where you can't hear, can't see, can't, you know, whatever. And it's forcing me to use my time well. I don't know that, to tell you the truth, I don't know how other people get motivated. So it's hard for me to say whether or not that's a good way to get motivated or if that's something that you can do deliberately, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me ask you this. You know, one of the things that has always also interested me about you is sort of the way you have habits, rituals, consumption patterns, you know, cultural influences. And I'd love for you to talk about some of those things and how they've influenced your entire sort of creative process.
Mm-hmm. Hold on a second. I let my dog out in the back.
Okay.
And I just want to make sure. Yeah. Yeah. The gate is open. Right, come on back, you. Because if he goes out there, he's going to be in the fucking gonna be in the street, and that cat's not gonna work out. I'm just gonna bring him back inside. Okay, cool. So, is the question about cultural influences?
Well, a combination of all three things, you know, I mean, yeah. You've got rituals and habits and routines that I'd love for you to talk about. And then, of course, you know, one of the things that I've seen is that you have a lot of influences that other people don't have that influence your creativity. And I'd love for you to talk about those as well.
Yeah, I deliberately consume things that other people don't consume so that I can have different ideas than they do, you know, like, yeah, maybe, you know, sort of broadly speaking, maybe I see myself, you know, we're talking about tools and machines before.
Right.
And maybe I see myself as that, where I'm like this vessel and I need to absorb things to create different output than others. Most people create a certain kind of output, and it allows them to make certain things. And we know what the majority of those things are, you know. We see it around us every day, all the time. So if you're going to consume the same things, you're going to become and produce output, which is the same as others. So for a long time, I really tried hard to consume. And I mean, you know, the sort of simple version of that is the guy that reads all of the self-help books.
Right.
Which, you know, in my case back in the day was a good thing. Mm-hmm. It worked. And so it allows you to become a certain kind of person just by getting more output than others. And so I'm actually surrounded by books right now in my own home, and they're all in rainbow order, which is always nice. And I can look up and I'd be like, oh yeah, I remember this one, this one, this one, this one, this one. It's like, there's like thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
And every, you know, it's in, who's that dude who said, what's that book? It's called, I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell. What's the name of that guy?
Tucker Max.
Yeah, Tucker Max. I was at his house one time, and the dude is the most well-read for – I've never read his book.
Yeah.
But he's the most well-read, like literate, thoughtful guy who really, really thinks about everything that he does and really knows what he's doing.
Uh-huh.
And has a lot of philosophical backing to all this stuff. I was with Ryan Holiday as well. I don't know if you know him, but like same – we were together. I just think it's about like receiving all of this input. Now what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to turn myself into Peter, not turn myself into, but have the same inputs as Peter Thiel has. And that's really, really difficult because he's you know, is much smarter and better read than I am.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, but you're really a, whatever inputs you get, like that's plus the person you were when you were born. Like that's the person you become. So I seek out external stimulus that is different than most people.
You know, I love that. I mean, and it's funny because I've thought a lot about sort of the external stimulus that I seek out, you know, as an interviewer. I thought, you know, I should be listening to people that are absolutely the best at what they do. And I started thinking, I'm like, you know, really what I should be doing is watching The Daily Show, watching Jon Stewart, watching John Oliver, you know, watching Charlie Rose. Because, I mean, those are the best of breed when it comes to this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. You're right. You're right about that. And so, and... there's another version of that, which is that you should watch the worst interviews ever. Like you should have an impression of what the negative looks like as well.
Right.
So you have an impression of negative patterns and positive patterns.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, so we've talked about sort of your consumption patterns. I mean, what does your day to day look like? I mean, ritual. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the 1,000-word habit, which I definitely have cultivated because of you, but what else? I mean, what does a day in your life look like typically?
Yeah. So I'm the CEO of a small company now that is growing. And so my day is actually pretty mundane, but to give you an impression of where it comes from, I'm always like the purpose of the 1,000 words a day usually is like, okay, where is the bottleneck right now? Right. And so I'll seek out whatever that bottleneck is. I don't always have the answer, but I get an impression of what the bottleneck is. And then I'll be like, oh, there's that thing that's really important right now. So my bottleneck right now is hiring, and is hiring other executives to help run the increasing number of people that are in my company. And it's hiring a bunch of people for skill sets, because that's what you do when you're a CEO. You delegate over and over and over again until the only thing you have left to do is to think about the future. And so, and that's a really hard thing to do, just to hire well and consistency and consistently in a limited pool of talent where people are expensive if they're good and blah, 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 blah. So it's actually like, and so I'll go in and I'll be like, okay, so how do you hire exactly? I've literally never done it before. Like I was flipping out for like 2 weeks about how to write a job description for an office manager. Okay. Like that's the level of incompetence I'm at. Maybe that doesn't come across in this interview because I know how to use long words or something, but I would just like to clarify that I'm really, really ignorant about a lot of things. And so the only thing is that I'm like, I was actually telling this to someone, like, I have no idea how to do my job right now because I've never done it before. But I'll just go out and be like, so how do you do this exactly? And I, you know, I'll get advice from people that have invested money in our company, from other people that have been CEOs before, from, you know, advisors, from blah, 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 blah. And from that, I'll develop the structure of how to do that. But I think like the plain thing around that is even in this sense of uncertainty, which is really great uncertainty like you're talking about, you have to have this confidence about action. You sort of have a bias for action is what they call it. You're like, I don't know. Well, I might as well do something to see.
Yeah.
And so I base my entire day on like probably one or two bottlenecks. And those are different all the time. And then I'm like, how do I liberate this? How do I allow people to be more productive here? How do I, you know, that could be around raising money, or it could be around hiring more people, or it could be around letting more people do work. But it's really like, you know, I mean, in the simplest sense, I have an office job. I work way more than 9 to 5 now, but I do it because I feel like I'm building probably the biggest thing that I've ever done and I'll probably ever do ever.
Interesting. Well, let's do this. Let's take a few steps back. I mean, walk us through sort of the trajectory, because I know that, you know, what's interesting about you is, you know, you mentioned you started off as one of the first podcasters, then you became this, you know, wildly popular blogger slash author, and now, you know, a startup CEO. And I'd love for you to sort of walk us through the steps of all of that, and kind of some of the lessons that have come from each sort of reinvention.
Yeah. So I'll tell you a part of the story that you probably have never heard before, as well. So the what I do is I'll launch this thing. It doesn't matter what the thing is, but just think about this pattern, and it'll be like I'll be at zero experience launching something, and then I'll go out and I'll try that thing, and I'll you know, through I'm not always lucky, and it's not always like wildly successful. Sometimes it fails and so on, but there's a number of examples where I'll be the first at doing something, or one of the first at doing something. It'll allow me to get opportunity I'll take that opportunity. It'll take me to a plateau. I'll sit at that plateau for a while doing this thing, whatever this thing is, and then I'll see another trend and I'll be like, fuck yeah, that thing. And I'll just do it over and over and over again. And so, so the first one is that I became a podcaster, and I was one of the first podcasters in the world, so it allowed me to liberate myself from my job. And so the first thing is I became free. I liberated my hours to do more valuable thing than to earn what was probably at the time like $20 an hour, mm-hmm. something, you know. And so liberating your time from the money that you earn, even though it actually probably makes you broker the first time, is actually a really powerful thing. It's really important. So then you have a machine that helps build something for you. So I did that. But as a consequence of being one of the first podcasters and being one of the first commercial podcasters, they were trying to monetize podcasts and nobody knew how. And one of the things that people did is they gave people coupon codes, because coupon codes, as I'm sure that you understand as a podcaster, is one of the only ways that you can refer other people to your service. You know, if you have I give you a coupon code for Breather, mm-hmm. then the only way that you can ever, the Breather.com, can ever know that Srini got people to use it is if you refer them. And you can't refer them with a link because it's not on a website. You understand how, like, it's pretty basic.
Yeah, yeah,
of course. It's not on a website. And so, because of this, a few people had coupon codes for like the largest registrar in the world, which is GoDaddy. But there weren't a lot of people, and not a lot of them knew what the fuck they were doing. And at the time, I was like, well, wait, like this seems like it could be a thing. And as a consequence of a bit of experimentation, I became probably like the largest coupon code affiliate for GoDaddy in the world. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of money to be made there, and nobody knew about it, and it was a giant secret, and none of us talked about it at the time. Now it's like 8 years ago, so it doesn't matter anymore because that experiment is gone. And the people that went on to create the biggest websites about this are now public companies like RetailMeNot.com. They're mm-hmm. huge. They're worth billions of dollars. So I was very early on, and I would not have been able to get a coupon code or a set of coupon codes, which allowed me to make money on the internet without the podcasting. That liberated me even more. Now I was like, oh, well, I've got a bunch of money in the bank that I have never had access to. So this never happened to me before. Like, what will this allow me to do? So then I thought, okay, well, great. Well, I'm not going to stay becoming like hustling, you know, domain names on the internet forever. So I thought, well, I know how to write now. I've been writing a blog for a while, and we'd been going to conferences because I knew for sure that in order to get people to talk about my show, they would have to know me. And mm-hmm. I lived in Canada, so I couldn't let that happen. So it was like I would go to every conference. And so I met all of these sort of internet famous people in the early days of Web 2.0. And one of them was Chris Brogan, who ended up becoming my co-author. We started doing conferences together for free, and we started writing ebooks. And one of those ebooks became the world's first social media marketing book. Published in 2009, and it was an instant New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller. And so now I'm like, okay, I'm one of the first sort of blog to book authors. Mm-hmm. And so I did that, and that allowed me to sort of liberate a bunch of speaking engagements. And then I have all these, the social web is really what allowed us to be pros at this. So we were among the first people in the social web ever. So we developed a huge audience, which is what allowed us to get to a New York Times bestselling book in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so as a consequence, now I'm able to connect with really strong authors. So I connect with Seth Godin, and we use Amazon to create a free book. So now I have this book, right? And actually is one of the one of the only perpetually free books on Amazon. So if you go on Amazon now, there are no free books that are free forever. The most you can, if you're an author, you know mm-hmm. this, you can only make your book free for like 90 days. And so because of a deal that we got together at that time, which was only available at that time, we made the book free forever. And there's only, you know, I think Flinch might actually be the only free book available on Amazon, period, forever, aside from like the Bible. And so that allowed millions, literally millions of people to read the book. It's been read by everyone. I got to work with one of the best business authors in the world, arguably. And then I sat on that, and I wrote a third book as well, and it did well, and all these other things. But again, I was kind of on this plateau, and I thought, okay, And I'm really interested in this idea of space for a reason I didn't exactly understand, but I knew that as the world would get louder, a bunch of macro trends, as the world got louder, as the world, as cities got denser, as a bunch of other things like that happened, people would need private space, and private space would become more valuable. And I thought, well, if private space becomes more valuable, then I could create something, an engine for private space. And I've done that, and now I've raised $7.5 million. But it started, like, as soon as I had created this idea and told people about it, I got $1.5 million in funding. I recruited one of the best engineers in the world to be my CTO at the time. And now I've built it, and it works in three cities. And much like Steve Jobs in 1985 in that interview from Playboy that I was telling you about, people, one of the most common questions that people ask me is like, what is this useful for? And I actually think that it's one of the most useful platforms in the world, and that it'll become incredibly valuable. And as you were telling me before, it's super risky, and I bet like basically my life and my career on it. My impression is that in the future, having access to be able to open 1,000 doors from your pocket is an incredibly powerful thing. And it'll become a platform that is incredibly valuable and useful. So over and over and over again, you're seeing sort of like, oh, and that led me to this, which gave me this specific access, and this specific access allowed me to do this new thing. Mm-hmm. And this new thing allowed me to open this door. And over and over and over and over again, I think you'll see that in almost everybody, you know, in almost anybody who's done anything of significance or whatever.
You know, it's interesting because I can kind of have, you know, mention a similar pattern. I mean, obviously, you know, ours is more, you know, book to conference to, you know, media company, but mm-hmm. really starting out as just this small little podcast where you plugged in a microphone into a laptop. So I definitely get, because you're right. I mean, each thing gives you access to the next thing. Because you have a little more money, so you can take bigger risks. And that's one of the most important things I've learned. I want to start wrapping things up here, but one last sort of thing around this whole period, recognizing when you're at a plateau, because I mean, this is really one of the big reasons I wanted to have you here is because I see that you're very smart at knowing, okay, it's time to move on from this thing.
Hmm. How do I know that?
Yeah.
I don't know how I know that. To me, it kind of goes back a little bit to like, is this the top? Like, did I create this incredibly valuable thing? If so, can it exist without me?
Mm-hmm.
Like with Flinch, it's a book, it's out. It's, you know, people are talking about it. Even now it's in the top, you know, free books on Kindle books on Amazon. And so I can just walk away from that. You know, it's nice because with a book, you can do that. And the other part is whether this is challenging or not, or kind of like another version of that is, can someone else do this?
Mm-hmm.
And no one else probably could. I mean, you know, there are other, you know, there's the War of Art. There's a few other books like Flinch that are kind of like that. And that I'm sure a lot of people have read as well, but I really felt like that was my version of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I did something that nobody else could do. And so if somebody else can write the book or someone else can do the thing, then I'll probably let somebody else do it.
Right.
And then I'll work on something where I seem to have an advantage. And the other way is just, well, my God, like this is, it really, when you're doing it, it really feels like this is what I was born to do.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that requires a certain sort of, arrogance or self-confidence or something. But when you hit it, you just know. And then you, for some reason, like I literally wrote down in my to-do list a place to sit in like May of 2012, which is two and a half years ago. And I was like, well, what would I do? What is this? I don't know. Well, how would I do this? I have no idea. And I wrote in my habits, work on secret project. And it didn't mean anything at the time because I was like, well, where is this going? I have no idea. But I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't have a name for it. I didn't have anything. I just wrote work on secret project. And every day I would just sort of check that off as I would make tiny incremental improvements to it. And it sort of happens by itself as well because you're on the plateau and then you're waiting for the thing to take off. Mm-hmm. And the thing will just kind of take off by itself, and it'll become clear over time as long as you can work on it a little bit every day or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe to me one of the biggest lessons here is how long you've stuck with something. And grit, I remember, was one of the things that you said really separates people who achieve these kinds of things from the ones who don't. Because, you know, we're looking at what we're doing with Unmistakable Creative. And, you know, I spoke about this recently at an event. And I said, you know, it's been half a decade. And yet we see this as just the beginning of a lot of the things that we're doing after half a decade.
Yeah, which is great. That's an amazing thing because... and you don't know where, that's the other thing to really clarify is you have no idea where it's going to take you. And if you tried to predict it, you would never would have been able to.
Right.
You know, like you would never say, and now we're going to get this amazing show with these unbelievable guests. And people be like, no. And even you will be like, no. And then it'll hit you in a way that you would totally never expect. And you just have to kind of see that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, I know you got to get going here, so I want to wrap with one final question. You know, and I think coming from you, it'll be really fascinating to hear your answer. What is it in your mind that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Jesus. I think, you know, I don't know. I just feel like if you're working, it's the work. It's actually not about you. Mm-hmm. I used to think that. I used to think it was about me, but it's actually not. It's about, like, you walk away and then this thing has happened. And then this thing is transformed, or the environment is transformed by the fact that the person was there. Mm-hmm. So when I, you know, I've got this Lego version of Rockefeller Center by my bed, and Rockefeller Center, when I go to New York, which is often, I stop there almost like it's a religious pilgrimage. And actually, we have breather locations right nearby, so I stop there too. And I look up at it, and it's because John Rockefeller Jr. built that, and he was given all of this money by his father. He was, you know, they were by far the richest men in the world. They were like the Bill Gates of their time. They had enduring monopolies in the oil business. And when I look up at that, I actually don't, I think about a guy who really could just have been a philanthropist whose job would have been, and that would have been significant enough to, like, because they literally created modern medicine. John Rockefeller Sr., his father was like a quack doctor. And largely in the 1850s when he existed, medicine didn't really exist. It was quack medicine and it was bullshit. So scientific research for medicine was largely bankrolled by John D. Rockefeller Sr. Mm-hmm. And it could not have existed without him and him taking all that money and throwing it in there. And for John Jr., he's sitting on this pile and he goes, what's the most significant thing that I can do with this pile? And Rockefeller Center is a part of that legacy. It was thought that it would be impossible to build. He almost went bankrupt doing it. No one would... had ever built anything like it before, and on and on and on with these impossibilities. And so when I think about your question, it really makes me think of, like, what is this impossible thing that I left a footprint on? And it could be very small or it could be very large, but it's this constant, like, it's this real devotion towards something where, yeah, like, it's unmistakable because it is so difficult and so enormous, you know, like Tim Cook always says. I was reading, doing a Charlie Rose interview. You should also watch Charlie Rose. He's a very good interviewer. And he said, and he always says, only Apple, you know, only Apple could do this, only Apple. And so you kind of think about that. You think about that about yourself and think, yeah, I'm worthy of this, which is the first part. And the second part is, and so what is, you know, only Srini or only Julian or whatever. And I don't know. That's kind of how I think about that question.
Well, I love it. Julian, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share some of your insights with our listeners here at Unmistakable Creative. It's great to have you back and been really fun to kind of watch your continual reinvention.
Thank you. I'm working on it.
And for those of you guys listening, we'll wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.